Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rex Factor! This week, Mary of Modena!
With your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Rex Factor, reviewing all the Queen and Prince consorts of England, from Elspeth to Prince Philip. Follow us on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Rex Factor Pod. Email rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com and sign up for bonus content at patreon.com/Rex Factor. This week, as you've heard, we are reviewing Mary of Modena, Queen consort to James II. Mary of Modena, probably one of the less familiar names in this series, but she was also at the centre of one of the most notorious incidents in English royal history, with the so-called warming pan baby.
Yes. What was it? Bedpan baby or something?
Yes. Well, we will be getting into the truth of this during the episode, but mainly, of course, finding out who Mary was and how she fared as queen.
Yee.
Biography!
Mary of Modena, or Maria Beatrice Eleonora Anna Margarita Isabel d'Este.
Wow, that's a mouthful, isn't it?
Was born on the 5th of October 1658, the daughter of Alfonso IV, Duke of Modena, and Laura Martinozzi.
This is amazing. We're definitely, we're 17 something. We're talking, I mean, she's going to live into 17 something.
That's bad. That's your prediction. Modena is a duchy, or was a duchy, in northern Italy, and Mary was born in the Ducal Palace, built by her grandfather. And after her father's death when she was only 4 years old, her younger brother inherits the dukedom, so her mother is a very effective regent for Modena, improves the economy and oversees Mary's education. So Lloyd Llewellyn Jones has suggested that Mary was perhaps the best educated English queen since Elizabeth I.
Oh, wow.
So she's very literate, musical, artistic, fluent in French and Italian, also adept at Latin, and later picks up English pretty easily.
Yeah, it's normally a good sign when they have a role model who's a powerful, successful female, doesn't it? That they can, or a mother usually.
Now, at the age of 14, Mary attracted the attention of representatives of the younger brother of Charles II, the Duke of York, future James II. So following the death of his first wife, Anne Hyde, James wanted someone young and beautiful, quote.
Yeah, well, and unusual.
Yes, bit of an odd one, chaps, I was thinking. But also, as a recent Catholic convert, James also wants a Catholic bride.
Convert?
Yes.
So he wasn't brought up a Catholic?
No, so his mother, Henrietta Maria, was notoriously Catholic, but Charles I, his father, wasn't. Mary very much fits the bill, and indeed Modena's status as a sort of client duchy for Louis XIV of France, who is a cousin of James and Charles II, also makes this an appealing match. It helps to sort of bind those ties a little tighter.
Okay.
So it's appealing for England, but not for Modena. Mary's mother seemed to have wanted a grander match than a younger son, so she seems to have perhaps been angling after Charles II of Spain. However, she has to begrudgingly admit that her daughter is available under pressure from Louis and France, who are very much behind the match. However, Mary herself also needs some persuading, as she was so Catholic that she actually wanted to become a nun.
Whoa, that is distilled Catholicism right there.
So it took a direct appeal from Pope Clement X to actually persuade her to marry and not be a nun.
Yeah, I mean, he probably said, we've got loads of those. we could really do with you over in England.
Well, indeed. So he effectively appoints her a Catholic missionary. So he says to her, considering in effect the influence of your virtues, we easily conceived a firm hope that an end might come to the persecution still smouldering in that kingdom, and that the Orthodox faith, reinstated by you in a place of honour, might recover the splendour and security of former days.
How long ago are those former days these days? When did we last have a Catholic on the throne?
But the last Catholic monarch was Mary the First.
Oh, yeah.
Philip II of Spain. So, I mean, that's the 1550s. So
100 years ago.
Yeah, it's 100 years.
Gosh, two generations. It's sort of that embedded change then.
So no pressure then. She was sort of almost starting the way that you always urge them to finish and just retiring to a monastery and living quietly. But the Pope says, nope, go to England and make it Catholic again.
Sorry, so does she see this as like a religious mission as well?
Well, I mean, that's one. When you get your orders from the Pope as a good Catholic, you sort of have to begrudgingly accept that you got to do what he says.
You're going to go and get the band back together.
Exactly. So reluctantly, Mary agrees to the marriage, and on her 15th birthday, leaves Modena with her mother weeping at her fate. On her way, she's treated as an honoured guest in Paris, with Louis XIV, who, as I said, had thrown his weight behind the marriage, gifting her a brooch worth £8,000.
Nice.
So unfortunately, there's not such a warm welcome awaiting her in England. Mary and James had been married by proxy before her departure from Modena, but Parliament is so opposed to the match because of her Catholicism that they pass an urgent motion urging Charles to break the marriage off and send the Pope's daughter, as they call her, back to Modena, basically as soon as she arrives.
Yeah, that's a point. So is James into this then?
James very much into this. Charles says, yep, that's good as well, but Parliament, very Protestant, is not happy at James marrying a Catholic. Because the issue is that whilst Charles is ostensibly at least Protestant, and he is married to Catherine of Braganza, he doesn't have any legitimate children. So this is 13 years into the reign, a good sort of decade or so into his marriage. So the likelihood of James becoming king is growing. Now, James does have a couple of Protestant daughters, but of course, if he remarries to a Catholic and has a Catholic son...
Uh-oh.
Exactly. Yeah. Charles, of course, refuses this petition and indeed suspends Parliament for a time so that they can't annul the marriage before it even starts. For Mary, though, she's not really bothered about the politics at this point. Her concerns are more personal. James is 25 years older than her, at 40, scarred by smallpox and reputed to be the most unguarded ogler of his time.
Gosh, and he's around with peeps, isn't he?
He is. And Charles.
And Charles, yeah. Oh, what a trio.
Not surprisingly, poor old Mary bursts into tears when she sees him for the first time.
Yeah. Oh.
In contrast, James is very pleased with Mary. The Earl of Peterborough described her. Tall and admirably shaped, her complexion was of the last degree of fairness, her hair black as jet. So were her eyebrows and her eyes, but the latter so full of light and sweetness as they did dazzle and charm. And in the whole turn of her face, which was of the most graceful oval that could be framed, there was all the features, all the beauty, and all that could be great and charming in any humane creature.
Good. Is she a nice person?
Yes, it seems to be nice. And indeed, thankfully, she does actually settle in at court quite quickly. She gets on well with Charles, who's very kind to her, and she does gradually fall in love with James.
Right.
He treats her with kindness, and Mary reports to the Mother Superior of the Visitation at Modena that the Duke is a very good man. He has the holy fear of God and is very kind to me and would do anything to show it. He is firm and steady in our holy religion, which he professes as a good Catholic, that he would not change it for anything in the world. And in my affliction, which is increased by the departure of my dear mamma, this is my consolation.
I see what's going to happen here. She was already pretty fervent, and that seems to be her bit of driftwood that she clings to in a foreign sea.
Yeah. She's also now stepmother to James's two daughters from his first marriage, Princess Mary and Princess Anne.
Oh, and who are how old?
Well, Princess Mary's only a few years younger than Mary, and rather ickily, yeah. James introduces her by telling Princess Mary that he had provided a playfellow for her.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. This really wasn't a thing, was it, back then? It just didn't... Yeah, okay.
Nevertheless, they get on very well, Princess Mary and Mary. I'll refer to her as Princess Mary throughout, just to make it a bit easier. So, yes, they get on very well with each other. They both are weeping in excess of sorrow when Princess Mary has to leave for Holland on marrying William of Orange in 1677. Though they still write to each other very often, and Mary nicknames her Lemon.
That Mary. Of course. As in Mary and...
William and Mary.
William and Mary, yes. Yeah.
But yes, Lemon to go with Orange, presumably.
Oh, yeah.
Relations with Anne, the younger daughter, are... a bit trickier. So in 1674, the House of Lords forced Charles to remove the princesses from James's household, and thus obviously also from Mary, to make sure that they are raised as Protestants. And while Mary, Princess Mary being a little bit older, it may be a bit easier to establish that rapport, Anne does prove a bit more evangelical in her Anglicanism, and increasingly a bit more disapproving of Mary as a Catholic.
Spoiler alert, is that the same Anne as well?
Queen Anne, will become, yes.
Wow.
Yeah, they're all about at this court.
Yeah.
Anyway, the hope from James's perspective, of course, is still that Mary will have her own children by him. But despite 10 pregnancies, only 4 result in living children. So there's a son, Charles, who sadly dies of smallpox at just a month old. A daughter, Isabella, who dies at the age of 4. And the death of another baby girl, followed by 2 stillbirths, which mean it's increasingly assumed that, sadly, Mary won't be able to have a child.
Well, that's heartbreaking.
Mm. A similar situation to Anne as well, of course. There's many, many children.
Mm.
However, while Mary takes comfort in, as she writes, having more angels to pray for me, she does continue to hope that God will one day comfort me by giving me a male child who shall live.
Mm. The tremendous pressure these poor women put themselves under, or are put under...
Now, whilst Mary is visiting William and Mary in 1678, she pops over to the continent, national hysteria breaks out over the Popish plot. So this is what we discussed with Catherine of Braganza previously, a series of Catholic conspiracies published by Titus Oates and various others.
Oh, yeah.
And Oates' claims gained credence with the discovery of some secret correspondence by a chap called Edward Coleman, who was sort of technically Mary's secretary. She doesn't have much of a relationship with him, but he was writing to France seeking a pro-Catholic alliance. And the discovery of these papers gives credence to all the other extreme things that Oates is talking about.
Mm.
Now, neither Mary or James seem to have any involvement in what Coleman's doing. He's very much out on a limb. But nevertheless, the accusations swirl further. The Earl of Shaftesbury leads a parliamentary move to have James removed from the line of succession, which is known as the exclusion crisis. So when Mary returns from Holland, she writes to her brother in Modena, "There are so many intrigues, bogus plots and accusations. I grieve for the extremes of suffering of the poor Catholics. The state of Catholics is pitiable. I have been forced to dismiss all the English Catholics in my household."
By the king?
Well, by Parliament, really. It's one of those where Charles is struggling to maintain control. And indeed, it becomes so fraught, Charles actually orders James and Mary to leave the country for their own safety, and probably, to a certain extent, his. So initially, they go off to Brussels, and then they set themselves up in some magnificence at Holyrood Palace in Scotland.
Oh, because he's... So at this point, he's still like King Brother, isn't he? To the Scots as well, but a separate state, so he can go and hide there. It's not
he can go and hide there. He's appointed Lord High Commissioner of Scotland. But these are difficult times for Mary, so it was while they're in Edinburgh that the daughter Isabella died, still in London, which obviously, as you can imagine, plunges Mary into a deep religious mania that caused her physician some concern. A false accusation is made against Mary's mother, having offered £10,000 for Charles's murder.
Hmm.
But opinion does gradually turn against the agitators with fear of England slipping into civil war again. And Charles dismisses Parliament for the rest of his reign in 1681, and James and Mary are thus able to return. And indeed then, a couple of years later, 1683, the discovery of the Rye House Plot, which aimed to kill Charles and James and spark a Republican revolution, perhaps, actually sees an upsurge in popularity for James.
Okay. Who would have thought it?
Well, indeed. So it's actually then with a surprising ease that when Charles II dies in February 1685, James accedes to the throne without really facing any opposition at first.
And we just have a Catholic king.
Yeah, they're anointed and crowned in a secret private service by a Catholic bishop, but despite this, they do participate in a public Protestant coronation ceremony. And this is the first joint coronation since Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon in terms of a full-on, both of them really very engaged. So remember, Henrietta Maria didn't go to Charles's coronation with him. Catherine of Braganza wasn't given a coronation. Anne of Denmark did go to the coronation, but she didn't fully partake because she refused to speak some of the Anglican words. But this is the first time we've had both the king and the queen completely engaging in everything. Now, while many of the crown jewels have been remade for the coronation of Charles II, as I just said there, Catherine of Braganza hadn't been there, she hadn't been married to Charles yet, and doesn't get her own coronation, which means that new pieces need to be made for Mary as queen consort.
Oh, that's a fun job, isn't it?
So James spends vast amounts on this. Her crown alone costs £10,000.
Crikey.
One eyewitness observed that the jewels she had on were reckoned worth £1 million, which made her shine like an angel. Mary herself later reminisced, "My dress and royal mantle were covered with precious stones, and I took all the jewels that all the goldsmiths in London could procure to decorate my crown."
Mm. Nice.
And it's quite a good start for them. James retains many of the advisers employed by Charles II and largely offered forgiveness to the exclusionists. Later in the year, he does face rebellion in Scotland and England with the Duke of Monmouth, Charles II's illegitimate son. Tried to take the crown, but both of these are defeated pretty easily. Mary's health is poor at this time, and some European diplomats are actually starting to line up potential replacements for her. But she recovers her health, moves into apartments at Whitehall that have been newly renovated at great expense by Christopher Wren.
Nice.
But there are some concerns with what's going on. His early successes means that James has a bit of confidence to do a bit more Catholic stuff. So he openly promotes religious tolerance of the Declaration of Indulgence and, against Mary's advice, promotes various Catholic offices and ignores the requirements of their having to take a Protestant oath in order to take office. Mm. He even tries to get a cardinal's hat for a controversial Jesuit priest in his service.
Tries to get a cardinal's hat? Wants to dress him up as if everything was normal and Catholic?
Wants him appointed as a cat. Wants the Pope to make this guy a cardinal.
Right. Not just kit him out in the gear and pretend.
And a particular concern is that James wants to create a standing army, for which there isn't really any tradition in England. It's seen as a foreign, French, absolute Catholic sort of thing.
Right.
Now, the accession was acceptable, partly, as I said, he'd had a bit more popularity in the final years of Charles's reign, but also because James and Mary don't have any children. So even if James is making these Catholic reforms, Protestants know that they just have to wait for James to die, and then his Protestant daughters will come along and undo any Catholic reforms. But James and Mary do continue to hope for children. And in 1687, James goes on a pilgrimage to Holywell, while Mary takes the waters at Bath, and incredibly, it works. So for the first time in 5 years, Mary is pregnant.
Okay, so trouble's brewing.
Well, yes, so it's obviously lovely news for James and Mary, but for Protestants in the country, shock and panic set in. What if, God forbid, she has a boy?
But, I mean, isn't it all right now? Because he's talking about religious tolerance and it doesn't really matter.
No, they don't want religious tolerance. This is a really bad thing. You may have thought that this seems like quite a nice thing that James is doing, but no, this is really shocking. Where will it end?
All right.
So Protestants are very anti all of this leniency towards Catholicism, and they see it that ultimately James is going to try to turn England into a Catholic state.
Right.
Because if it's a girl, of course, she would still be below the older daughters.
Of course.
So if it's a girl, it doesn't really matter, but if it's a boy, he goes to the top and becomes the heir. So there's widespread scepticism at Mary's pregnancy. People decide it seems too convenient after all these years that she's pregnant again. So there are some claims that it's being faked or that maybe Mary has some kind of illness that makes her tummy look big. And indeed, the sceptic in chief is her stepdaughter, Anne.
Oh.
Anne writes numerous letters to her sister, stating that there was much reason to believe it is a false belly.
Which one's her sister?
William and Mary.
William and Mary, okay.
So yeah. By now, Anne has really developed a deep antipathy for Mary. She blames Mary, wrongly, for James's conversion to Catholicism, because it has already happened, but he didn't go public for a while. So Anne thinks Mary comes along and suddenly my father's a Catholic.
And she's the younger daughter, and there's now a stepmother.
Yeah.
I've seen this play out before.
Yeah. She also blames Mary for a delay in James settling her financial settlement. Again, really nothing to do with Mary. And regularly denigrates Mary to her confidants.
Okay, so she's really critical in this story.
Very much so. In January 1688, New Year's prayers are ordered to celebrate the pregnancy, but not many people turn out to make the prayer. And Lord Clarendon wrote with some concern, "It is strange to see how the Queen's great belly is everywhere ridiculed, as if scarce anybody believed it to be true. Good God help us!"
So it's an age of conspiracy.
Indeed.
I'd like to say.
Fake news.
Yeah. But she absolutely was pregnant.
Well, on the 10th of June, 1688, a month before the expected due date, Mary gives birth to a healthy boy christened James Francis Edward Stuart.
Uh-oh.
Wonderful news for Mary and James, the worst possible outcome for Protestants, because, as you said, he leapfrogs the princesses, he will be the next in line, he will be raised a Catholic, there will be a Catholic succession.
It's quite easy to overthrow all that hard work the past 200 years we've been going through.
Well, exactly.
Just have a boy.
Exactly. By God, we can't let this happen. So the conspiracy theories swirl once more. While there had been many witnesses to the birth, many leading Protestants had been absent. Most notably, Anne was not there and was not witness. So she writes to her sister and to William, confirming the rumours that the prince was not really Mary's son, but instead a changeling, a so-called bedpan or warming pan baby, meaning that it was brought through on this sort of big warming pan that they used to warm the beds and just then placed with Mary and go, "Oh, look, baby boy." So it's smuggled in either to make up for a stillborn child or indeed just a completely false pregnancy.
I can believe the stillborn child thing a bit more than a false pregnancy. Mm. Walking around for 9 months with a pillow up there.
Yeah, it's harder work, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, regardless of the veracity of the rumours, and we'll talk about that in more detail in Scandal, the most important thing in 1688 was that many people believe the rumours, or at least they choose to believe them. And then in this context, James really fans the flame. So he tried 7 bishops for seditious libel when they refused to read out the Declaration of Indulgence.
What's that?
His religious toleration bill.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah.
And this leads to widespread anti-Catholic riots. And then 7 leading Protestants write to William of Orange, inviting him to invade on behalf of Princess Mary.
God, that escalated fast.
And indeed, William has already independently been planning to potentially invade.
Right.
Because William and Mary have very much been expecting that they will accede to the throne at some point. Because James not had an heir for all this time. William already has invasion plans, and he lands in Devon with 20,000 men on the 5th of November.
Ooh.
An auspiciously anti-Catholic date. Now, James has high confidence that he's going to prevail against this, as he had done against Monmouth, but he suffers numerous high-profile defections once William arrives, most notably one of his leading officers, John Churchill, the future Duke of Marlborough.
Oh, yeah.
And then his own daughter, Anne.
How could her defection is just like a public, "I'm on the other side"?
Yes. Okay. Anne's defection has the biggest impact on him, and James crying out, "God help me, my own children have forsaken me." James offers negotiations to William, but as a son of Charles I, he's obviously concerned what happens when you are put in such a position. So he is immediately planning to get himself out of the country as soon as possible. So after a failed attempt to get their son out of the country first, Mary then takes him in person to France, leaving in the early hours of the 10th of December and successfully making it to Calais. After a scuppered attempt for James to follow himself the next day, he finally is able to escape on the 23rd of December. And then Parliament decides that this act constitutes an abdication of the throne and consequently the end of his and Mary's reign.
He just leaves.
Runs away.
Okay. Wow. Well, I mean, just feel like that escalated and ended really quickly.
It did, yeah.
It went totally smoothly as far as the plotters or the succeeding lot would hope. I mean, were there even any battles?
Well, not in 1688, but James has not given up on the throne. Mary, on arrival in France, initially, of course, without James, wrote to Louis, wrote to Louis the 14th, begging for assistance. "Sire, a poor fugitive queen bathed in tears has not feared to brave the perils of the sea, to seek consolation and refuge from the greatest king and most generous monarch in the world. Her most precious possession in the person of her son, the Prince of Wales, who is as yet too young to share her gratitude. It lies entirely in my heart, and it is a pleasure to me in the midst of all my grief to come under the shadow of your protection."
She is begging, isn't she?
Indeed. So Louis readily agrees to provide sanctuary, so receives them, and then James as well when he arrives, at Versailles. It's a magnificent palace and court where they are treated with great respect. Louis grants them their own palace just outside of Paris, which is Saint-Germain-en-Laye, where Henrietta Maria had lived in exile, and indeed where Louis himself had been born.
So it's like an English bolt hole for English... what are they called?
Exiles, refugees. Exiles. Lost the crown again, have we? Right, well, there you go. It's still...
still warm.
Yeah. Due to an absence of an official queen at the French court, Mary's actually becomes the most senior lady at the French court, because she's still considered at France to be queen of England.
Yeah. That's... So, sorry, I'm going totally... I'm thinking totally of that TV show Versailles.
Yes.
But in amongst all that, the most senior woman is Mary of Modena.
For a time, yes. So Louis's first wife has died and he has a morganatic marriage. So she is queen because Louis's daughter-in-law died. He doesn't have a fully official queen himself, so there is a period where Mary is the only queen.
Oh, right.
However, following James's defeat by William in Ireland at the Battle of the Boyne in 1690... And in Ireland, the hopes of regaining the crown are pretty much over. And indeed, Mary never returns to England. So her Jacobite supporters call her the Queen over the water. Mm. She does also have one more daughter. She also has another child by James in exile, Louise Maria, who James declares his La Consolatrice, his consolation.
Mm.
Which again is perhaps an acknowledgement that...
It's over. Yeah.
And
that's nice.
Mm, and indeed it is over. So James dies in 1701 and forgives his enemies on his deathbed, including William and Mary and Anne, and then commends his youngest children to Mary. And Louis XIV is so moved that in spite of recent treaties and his better judgment, he does recognise Mary's son as King James III.
Wow. So they must have been best buds. They must have been really tight.
Oh, yeah. Mary's inconsolable for a short time, initially retires to a convent, but then she comes back and actually acts as regent, because James III, as he would be, is only 13. So for Jacobites, for the next 5 years, Mary is de jure regent of England, Scotland and Ireland.
Yeah. But...
not technically... in charge in terms of telling people in England, Scotland and Ireland what to do, but as far as Jacobites are concerned, she is Queen Regent.
Well, so am I, as far as Alistair is concerned. I'm Alistair the First.
After this, however, when her son becomes 18, she slips into the background. He becomes known as the Old Pretender. It's an unsuccessful attempt to land in Scotland in 1708, and he also rejects some feelers from England about whether he would consider converting to Protestantism. In return
Why,
for which...
Because
he's a Catholic.
Because Anne doesn't have children.
Anne doesn't have surviving children, so they're saying, well, if you would convert to be a Protestant, then you maybe might be next in line, but he's not going to do it.
So who's the young pretender, then?
That will be his son, which is Bonnie Prince Charlie.
Oh, I thought that came first.
No, okay. In 1712, he falls ill with smallpox, and whilst he survives, sadly, his younger sister... does not, and she dies at the age of just 19.
That's so grim.
She was a very popular figure in France and is greatly mourned, so Louise Morganatic wife, Madame de Maintenon, noted, "I had the honour of passing 2 hours with the Queen of England, who is the very image of desolation. The princess had become her friend and only consolation." So 1712 was a really terrible year for Mary, so the Treaty of Utrecht required that James leaves France, so she loses basically both of her children in 1 year.
Why does he have to leave France?
France and England make a peace treaty. So part of the terms England demand is that they don't shelter him anymore. Oh, you know, Italy and
low countries
around, yeah. So she's deprived of both her children the same year. So she's left a sort of matriarch at Jacobite court of Saint-Germain, but in a permanent state of decline. And indeed, she's almost sort of living in virtual poverty. She can't really travel by her own means because she can't afford to replace her horses, and find some comfort at the convent of Chaillot, which is, again, a nunnery founded by Henrietta Maria.
Doesn't Louis bung her a wedge?
He bungs a wedge, but he dies as well. Some point along, and then it's one of those where the new person is like, this is all a bit awkward. Can't be bothered. Yeah. And finally, Mary dies on the 7th of May, 1718, at the age of 59. And she's buried at the convent, though sadly her tomb is destroyed during the French Revolution.
Well, she got her wish, I suppose.
Indeed. Sort of goes back to her original vocation.
Yeah.
So that was the life and consortship of Mary of Modena. We will review her after a quick break.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Battleliness!
Mary showed some courage during the Glorious Revolution, as it's known, in 1688, when James's reign came crashing down. James himself recalled that Mary was reluctant to leave him. "Her Majesty absolutely refused it in reference to herself, telling the king she was very willing the prince her son should be sent to France, or where it was thought most proper for his security, that she could bear such a separation with patience, but could never endure it in reference to himself, that she would infinitely rather run his fortune, whatever it should prove, than abandon him in that distress."
So she really does like... I keep forgetting she's 30 years younger than him. What a strange match.
And when she leaves Whitehall, eventually she's persuaded to go, she leaves in the pitch black of the early hours, dressed as the laundry woman. Stuart, so obviously dressing up.
Yeah. But that was, surely that's fooling no one, isn't it?
Who's well, it's very, very dark, isn't it? So if you do sort of see someone at the corner of your eye, you think, oh, it's just some...
laundry woman.
And it's a very, very small group as well. So she only takes with her the young prince, who's just 6 months old, and two attendants. So they do slip out undetected, take a coach, drive unnoticed through streets of London to down to the Thames. Miraculously, the little baby James stays silent throughout.
Yeah. And I guess the coach was not a flamboyant thing. It was just sort of a Mondeo equivalent.
Yeah. Take a boat upriver to Gravesend, and from there they get a yacht the next morning to Calais. So she has all of that, only two servants and a six-month-old baby. So, you know, that takes a certain amount of courage to do all of that.
Yeah, I mean, she has still got two servants, though, hasn't she?
Yeah, but just two maids that are with her. You know, still, you don't know what's going on. It's not that long since the Civil War and Charles I getting his head cut off, and Henrietta Maria herself, obviously, was very unpopular. Mary herself is, obviously, as a Catholic queen, the focus of a lot of ire. So, you know, you would be worried if you got captured. And, indeed, James... when he sets off the next day, he shows that it's a bit easier said than done, because he gets captured by a fisherman who thought he was a Catholic priest and is brought back.
So everyone is just out to catch Catholics regardless.
Yeah.
If a fisherman sees someone else fishing and suspects that they might have some strange beliefs about transubstantiation,
yes,
and hoiks and boards him.
Once in exile, Mary does her bit to support the Jacobite cause. Whilst James is campaigning in Ireland, Mary organises the dispatch of three French supply ships to Bantry Bay and sold many of her jewels to raise £2,000 to send to Jacobite soldiers in Dundee. And as you said, after her husband's death, she is for 5 years regent of her son, so she does preside over his regency council, so she's not just a figurehead. After James's death, she wrote to Anne, describing her husband's dying wish to confirm you in the resolution of repairing to his son the wrong done to himself, perhaps implying that there's a bit of negotiations going on with Mary and Anne about one day recognising her son as Anne's heir.
Can you disentangle that phrasing? What
to confirm, I mean, it's deliberately obtuse, but to confirm you, Anne, in the resolution of repairing to his son, i.e. the prince, the wrong done to himself, i.e. the usurpation.
Right. I'm surprised they were even writing.
Well, we're sort of saying as a positive it shows Mary negotiating and being part of it. I suppose the negative is that probably Anne's just trying to say, oh, yeah, just stick with me when I'm queen. If you make sure that I'm queen without any opposition, maybe we'll sort something out for that prince later on.
Okay.
So she wants to make sure that she doesn't face a rebellion when she becomes queen. Doesn't actually really promise anything in return. Mary is at times approached by Scottish lords urging her to send young James as a figurehead for uprisings, but Mary refuses to risk him, and these uprisings all peter out, which not necessarily incredibly battily that she doesn't want to risk it, but it does at least show that she's got a certain amount of agency. She is genuinely in charge.
She's got a say.
She has a say. People come to her and say, let's have a rebellion, let's have the son, and she says, no, you're not having him. And she has the authority at this stage, so she is genuine regent.
Yeah. Right. Good.
On the other hand, she actually inadvertently plays a hand in quickening the collapse of James's rule. Because, as I said, following William's invasion, when Marlborough defects, along with Prince George of Denmark, that we'll be doing next time, Anne's husband, they sort of pop off together, James sent Mary an instruction to secure the Princess of Denmark, i.e. Anne. And whilst the defection is a devastating shock, James nevertheless had obviously seen the danger that Anne might go, or they might be taken. Mary, however, doesn't seem to have been quite so alert to it. Her Majesty, out of her good nature, only ordered a strict guard to be set about the princess's lodging, and said she was not to be disturbed till the morning.
Yeah.
So, basically, got a guard around the room, but otherwise isn't bothering Anne, doesn't keep a close eye on her, and sure enough, when Anne is gone in the morning, Mary screamed out as if she had been mad, initially assuming Anne must have been abducted, but soon the defection is realised and it very much takes the fight out of James. And that's all I got for battliness.
Oh, right. It's not good, Graham.
She's not really a battly character. It's, you know, I guess, a question of whether do we give her any credit for having to show a bit of courage and running away and then not fighting. The courage to run away and agency not to fight back.
And then it's given the most simple of military tasks, post a guard. Half.
Yeah, I feel like I want to give her a half for showing a little bit of courage and agency, but no more than that, because she's not a battly character.
Yeah.
So that's a one for battliness.
Scandal!
Well, Mary is the subject of one of the most notorious episodes in English royal history, the scandal of the bedpan baby, her son, by James II. As I said, from the moment the pregnancy was declared, Londoners were scoffing and ridiculing the pregnancy. Some claimed she was suffering from dropsy. Cartoons showed her just pinning a cushion inside her gown. And when the birth comes, it's very quickly questioned. So Bishop Burnett wrote, "No cries were heard from the child, nor was it showed to those in the room. It was pretended more air was necessary. The underdresser went out with the child, or somewhat else, in her arms to a dressing room, to which there was a door near the Queen's bed, but there was another entry to it from the other apartments."
Okay, and that's where the swap happened.
So whatever the truth of all of this, it was a scandal. Many people believe the rumours, and indeed William's justification for invasion does include the Queen's pretended bigness.
Oh, what a lovely turn of phrase. Well, I mean, I don't believe the pretended bigness, but I do believe that it's seriously scandalous. I mean, it's up there, isn't it? I've heard of that.
You've heard of that, exactly. You've not necessarily heard of her, but you've heard of that.
Yeah.
But, must be said, the naysayers are excessively biased. And really, there's a determination the pregnancy had to be false because they can't bear the reality of a Catholic succession. And this is particularly true of Anne, who, in addition to her religious and personal prejudice, had recently suffered the emotional turmoil of having lost two daughters and suffered two miscarriages in the space of a couple of months before Mary's pregnancy.
Oh, really? And that continues, isn't it?
So a Tuscan envoy recorded in December 1687... No words can express the rage and anguish of the Princess of Denmark at the Queen's condition. She can dissimulate it to no one, and seeing that the Catholic religion has a prospect of advancement, she affects more than ever, both in public and private, to show herself hostile to it and to be the most zealous of Protestants. So during the pregnancy, Anne wrote to her sister that her great belly is a little suspicious and that she suspected wicked foul play, arguing that if it were a real pregnancy, she should, to convince the world, make either me or her friends feel her belly. But quite contrary, whenever one talks of her being with child, she looks as if she were afraid to let anyone touch her.
I'm not surprised.
Well, except James and Mary claim that Anne did feel the baby move, as do many other Protestant ladies. And indeed, there were somewhere between 40 and 60 witnesses to the birth, including Catherine of Braganza. And there were many Protestant witnesses who took an oath to attest that the child was born of Mary's body. And the reason that Anne wasn't there was that she had elected to travel to a spa for her health, despite James requesting her presence, because almost certainly Anne wanted to avoid being a witness.
Yeah. Yeah, and Catherine Braganza is Charles II's...
What? Queen, so Queen Dowager now.
Okay.
Anne even questions a trusted witness, Mary's Protestant lady, Mrs. Dawson, who was there at the birth. And she described to Anne the long and arduous birth, how Mary didn't care about the gender, saying during the labour that she would compound for a girl with all her heart, and absolutely confirmed the veracity of it, which wasn't what Anne wanted to hear. And of course, she chose not to report this to her sister or William.
Yeah.
Many were outraged at the rumours, including the German portrait artist Godfrey Kneller, who said, "What the devil? I cannot be mistaken. His father and mother have sat to me about 30 times apiece, and I know every line and bit in their faces. I say the child is so like both that there is not a feature in his face but that it belongs either to his mother or father. I cannot be mistaken. Nay, the nails of his fingers are his mother's."
Is he a Protestant?
Well, I'm not sure, actually. Protestant Catholic, but he's pretty neutral, really. He's just painting. After the birth, James even sent an officer to inform Anne of the birth, but first made a point of showing the officer the baby in person so that he could attest to having seen that. But the Imperial ambassador rather shrewdly observed, it was doubtful if this would be enough to convince those whose malice was such that they are capable of believing whatever accords with their interests, even if their own eyes prove the opposite.
Oh, gosh, so it's forever been the case then.
Indeed, Mary's behaviour during the pregnancy and after also paints a different picture to that suggested by Anne. So a Dutch spy reported Mary being upset at being constantly told by Jesuits that the child must be a boy, to the extent that she actually burst into tears. She was deeply upset at the satires published during her pregnancy and wrote sadly to Princess Mary that it hurt her that she wouldn't wish to know her brother well, saying in a final letter to her, "I don't know what to say. Dissemble I cannot." So I think really the reality is that there is a conspiracy, but it's not a fake Catholic pregnancy. It's the Protestant pretense that it was a fake.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's ironic, of course. Mary I's reign had failed because she couldn't produce a son and heir, whereas James II's fails because Mary of Modena did produce one.
Oh, yeah.
So we have one of the most notorious episodes in royal history, but it's not true. It's her son. I don't think you get any historian saying that it wasn't her son.
Yeah. Oh, well, that I suppose that's not really the point, though, is it? It's this scandal that is brought up around it, which it is. I mean, it is clearly hugely scandalous at the time and brings about or plays a part in bringing about the fall of their reign.
Yeah.
I don't quite think it's up there with a Beckett job, though.
Because Beckett definitely did get slaughtered at the altar.
But it seems a bit more like everyone knows that. It's lasted longer in memory.
Yeah. Tricky, because we've had things like Anne Boleyn, who's, again, scandalous in other ways, but we think the main accusations weren't true. We have lots of things in this series where you get a lot of rumours made up about women as queens that you think, well, they might not be true, but equally, we don't want to just give them all nothing because there's a scandal there. But it feels a bit different. It doesn't feel like there's really anything about Mary's character or anything she's doing is simply prejudice because she's Catholic.
Mm. But it is over five, isn't it? I mean, it is. It's chunky. Six.
I'm going to go down because of the fact that it's nonsense. Really, even though it's a scandalous episode, it's hard to know how to deal with these. I feel like some of the other ones where it's not true, it feels like even if it isn't true, they've been in some way scandalous or really upsetting the apple cart. Or Mary, I don't feel like she's scandalous at all. It's purely...
It's not. No, she's not scandalous, is she? I suppose it's just something that happened. I think I'll stick with the six, though, because of the impact that scandal had.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I'm going to go three. But
really?
Just because I feel like it's she doesn't warrant a high scandal score for it.
God, that's the most divergent we've been for ages.
It is, and it's not... I think there are different ways of interpreting it. One is to say, well, it's a very scandalous event and it's her, therefore a high score, and the other is, I don't think it's to do with her, and anything she does sort of feels like it's somebody else's.
Mm.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting what people think of that, whether we score the event,
the person,
how you differentiate them. Anyway, three and a six. So a nine.
That feels good, actually. Absolutely.
Subjectivity.
Many accounts of Mary, not for man, obviously, suggest that she's a likeable figure, quickly adapts in a way that people have feared she wouldn't do from the stiff etiquette of Modena, Italian courts. She enjoyed games of blind man's buff, and Lady Duke was surprised that she was such a romp, as she proves.
God, those long winter evenings must just fly.
Well, she seems to have revelled in winter, so Lady Balisize noted. The Duchess is much delighted with making and throwing of snowballs, and pelted the Duke soundly with one the other day, and ran away quick into her closet and he after her, but she does not open the door. She hath also much pleasure in one of those sledges, and is pulled up and down the ponds in them every day.
I would be as well. If I had servants, I'd go everywhere by sledge, snow or no snow. That's sweet, isn't it? But that also is because she's 15 and he's 40.
Yes.
Or whatever it is.
She also proved a hit at Versailles, so impressed Louis XIV himself, became close friends with him and very high-level female figures, led by his morganatic wife, Madame de Maintenon. Madame de Sévigné praised her distinguished bearing and her quick wit.
Yep.
And this wasn't just pity or niceties on account of her status, because James II is largely excluded from her court life at Versailles, with contemporaries finding him rather dull, and one quipping that when one talks to him, one understands why he's here.
Oh, I see why he's here. Okay. Yeah. Okay, that's damning.
But that means with the praise for Mary, it's not just, oh, she's the queen, we have to pretend that she's great, because they like, God, James is awful. She's lovely, but he is awful.
Really?
Mary also shows some kindness in exile. She seeks to assist Jacobites who are brought into poverty by following them, encourages her children to donate some of their pocket money to Jacobite refugees.
Nice.
Now, we said at the start the Pope effectively charged her as a Catholic missionary to England, but she doesn't really seem to have tried to proselytise too much and eschews the outward trappings of Catholicism and largely keeps her devotions private, sort of similar to Catherine Braganza.
Well, that's sensible. I mean, and went along with that coronation business.
And went along with the coronation, exactly. Perhaps in a weird way, this reflects the depth of her piety, because she holds on to the ideal of retreating from the secular world, because she wanted to be a nun. Yeah. So in a way, she's perhaps a bit more able to internalise her faith. She doesn't need to show it, whereas James, as a convert, is a bit more flamboyant about it. He wants to tell the world.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So she's quite sensible in a way, so she even chooses to only receive her mother on visits to the continent after A visit with much pomp and ceremony in 1673 prompted large protests in London.
Right.
But Mary is sensitive enough to be like, you know what, let's keep this quiet. And actually, you know what, in fact, next time I'll just come to you. It's a bit funny over here.
It is a bit funny over here, isn't it? Most of the
time. Mary's also a very active patron of the arts in England. She's amused to various poets, including the poet laureate, John Dryden. Actively encourages the performance of plays, masks and operas. She's an Italian, brings that over. She also patronises numerous female artists and writers. So Aphra Behn writes various works for her. Anne Killigrew, one of her ladies. What Lloyd Llewellyn Jones has suggested is the closest England came to a society of précieuses, a sort of aristocratic French literary salon. And yet, despite all of this, she is not popular. That subjectivity question, would you want her to be your queen? They very much say no at the time. Catherine of Braganza, also Catholic, had been welcomed with 22 poems on her arrival to England. Mary only gets 5 and was met with a petition asking her to be sent home.
in rhyming couplets.
Albeit, of course, she was only becoming Duchess of York, but still was not welcomed. One satirical verse was particularly harsh, hoping that she would quickly be envenomed with the pox. So rather than in false hopes of being once a queen, die before 20, rot before 16.
Ooh, that's really horrid thing to hear about yourself.
Yes.
Or anyone else.
Barillon claimed that Mary spoke to Anne about converting to Catholicism, something which obviously just serves to anger Anne. And Anne claims that as queen, Mary became very susceptible to flattery and had an inflated sense of her own status. The queen, you must know, is of a very proud, haughty humour, and though she declares always that she loves sincerity and hates flattery, but when the grossest flattery in the world is said to her face, she seems extremely well pleased with it. It really is enough to turn one's stomach.
I tell you what, this Anne character needs to just turn it down a notch. She's really getting right up in her grill, isn't she?
She is. Anne also encapsulated the negative perception that many have of Mary. She is the most hated in the world of all sorts of people. She is a very great bigot in her way, and one may see by her that she hates all Protestants. She pretends to have a great deal of kindness to me, but I doubt it is not for real, for I never see proofs of it, but rather the contrary. And we might argue that Anne's probably the bigot in this relationship. Yeah. And that a lot of this criticism is reflecting virulent anti-Catholicism of the time rather than necessarily Mary being particularly odious.
I mean, are they living in the same household?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Perhaps rather than an evil presence plotting the downfall of Protestantism, the real criticism of Mary here should be that she has a very limited influence on English affairs.
Mm.
So everything we've been talking about really has been quite big picture and how it affects Mary. She herself, no real political role. She's a lot younger than James, had been intent on living as a nun, doesn't really have that much interest in political affairs. Feels like her whole role in the story is really quite passive.
Yeah, I agree. She is the muse for this, for other people's canvas.
Yes.
And for Anne, it's painting a picture of the devil, which she uses to oust her. But it don't feel like she's really doing any of the painting of opposite pictures. So what are we doing here?
Subjectivity.
It's low, isn't it? Mm. You're not going to want that after all of the argy-bargy from over the past few years.
I guess in her defence, she's not bringing the argy-bargy it's been brought to her. But
you still wouldn't want to be her subject because it brings that with it, even though it's not her.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I can't score this higher than 0.5 again.
I'm going to be a little more generous than that, because I do think that she herself is trying her best. Well, she's not trying her best, but she's being nice enough. I think a lot of the nastiness comes from Anne and others. I don't think that Mary herself really does much that's actually negative. It's just that
nobody
wants her there.
Yeah,
bit of cultural stuff, bit of snowballs.
Yeah. And she's a magnet for negative subjectivity. Which, yeah, isn't her fault, but it happens.
I'm going to give her a 2.
Okay.
So a half and a 2. 2.5 for subjectivity.
Longevity.
Mary is Queen Consort from the 6th of February 1685 to the 11th of December 1688, which is a reign of 3 years and 10 months. So 3.83 years, which equates to a score of 5, which is 44th best overall.
Oh, blimey.
Now, she's unlucky because, of course, that's with James being usurped as king. So if she'd been queen until his death in September 1701, that would have been a reign of 16 years and 7 months, 16.58. Plus, she then would have had time as queen mother, which would have been another 16.67 years. Half that to 8.34, so 16.58 plus 8.34 would have been 24.92 years of queenship and a score of 15, which would have been the 14th best.
But there we are.
She doesn't get any of that. James is usurped. She no longer is queen or queen mother. She has to make do with a score of 5.
Dynasty, not the programme.
Oddly, for dynasty, we do actually have a little bit of a debate to have here.
What?
Mary has 2 surviving children by James II, but one of these is born after the Glorious Revolution, when James has been usurped. Albeit, of course, the Jacobites would argue James was still the rightful king.
Well, I'm leaning on 1.
Yes, technically James isn't king when the second one is born, but he's still trying to become king.
But doesn't. And if he had,
Jacobites
his issue
had come back.
Yeah, and even if that person wasn't king himself, I think there'd be more case for it. But as it is, I'm afraid it's 1 for me. You could do 1.5.
Well, no, we could. It's meant to be a factual one. Okay. Well, Ali's letter of the law. Stamp putting his foot down.
How would you lean?
I was sort of inclined to be a bit generous to her because she hasn't got many other points, but we've got to have rules.
Yeah. This, as you say, this is not a subjective one, is it?
It's not a subjective one. So 1 legitimate child for James II as king. That gives her a score of 7.5 for dynasty, which is still almost as good as she's had in anything else. Joint 33rd, and that gives her a total score of 25. Joint 37th. With Joan of Navarre, then just above Elizabeth Cromwell. And we recall that Elizabeth Cromwell was in the Navarrese sandwich between and Berengaria of Navarre. So we've now got Elizabeth Cromwell and Mary of Modena in that sandwich.
I turned it into a club sandwich.
But it's not all about the score. Does she have that certain something, the lasting legacy, the great achievement, the star quality that we call
Rex Factor?
You're going to have to work very hard to persuade me of this.
Well, in a weird way, as if I minimise the detail as much as possible and reduce her story to bullet points, it does actually sound more impressive. Grows up an Italian duchy, moves to the Restoration Court, exiled by the Exclusion Crisis, becomes queen, bedpan baby, Glorious Revolution, leading lady at Versailles, regent for the Jacobite cause, Britain's last ever Catholic queen.
Oh, yeah, it does read better like that.
You'd make that film.
Well, yeah, you would. Can't think of anyone to slander here. You have a very dull actor taking the part and the film falls flat.
Yeah, it's all when you come to write the screenplay. It's like, right, so is there any more details to add to these bullet points? To be honest, not really. It's just kind of... Yeah. And they say, great, we'll just invent the rest then.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's... It just misses, doesn't it? It's the skeletons on which a Rexy character could have a field day.
Yes. It's a dramatic life and lots of big events around her. But, yeah, sadly, it feels like she's really a passive player in all of these. Ironically, she's almost most notably passive when she was the most active participant giving birth.
Oh, yes.
To the prince.
Yeah, yeah.
The moment she somehow weirdly has the least agency in the events that are going on when she is actually the one at the centre of it.
I do feel sorry for her to have all of that surrounding her. I mean, what a grim time for her.
She's treated very shabbily, it must be said.
But, yeah, I don't feel like it's us treating her shabbily by not giving her the Rex Factor. That's just I mean, she would have... I think if she heard this, as I often like to play, she'd have gone, fine, whatever, I only want to be a nun.
I didn't want any of this anyway.
Yeah, so let me just... Can I go? Yeah, brilliant.
Correspondence Corner.
So that is a no for Mary of Modena. She does not have the Rex Factor. Let us know what you thought about her. Get in touch on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Rex Factor Pod. Email rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com and remember to send in a hashtag concert card for an episode image of Mary.
Yeah, what would that be? A bedpan, I suppose.
And also do let us know, because we're getting towards the end of the Stuart Consort, so we'll then be doing our Write a Reply episode. So if you've got a message about Mary or any of the other ones that we've done in this mini-series, send in your thoughts and we'll be going through some of those after we finish the next one. If you'd like to support the podcast, be sure to subscribe on whatever podcast provider you use. Donate monthly, join the Privy Council and get access to well over 200 bonus episodes at patreon.com/RexFactor.
Cool. And join Discord. That's fun.
And we have some new Privy Councillors to welcome to the fold.
Elsie Brewster, Lynn Eulish, Elizabeth Piazza, Victoria Tesoniero, Tamsin Sapwell, Rebecca Wilcox, Rosalind Stewart, Dillo Chan, Alexa Wheeler, Telesilla, Rebecca Beckett, Claire Poika, Anne Catherine Niederberger, Nancy D, Jacob Whitworth, Nicola Grogan, Fiona Harris, Alison Wright, Melinda Haunton, Amy Schooley, Ashley Goff, Kimberly Stombaugh, Jemima Hock, Jeff King, and Lucinda King.
What Rexy names. Nice.
So that is all from us today. Next time we will be reviewing Prince George of Denmark, consort to Queen Anne, and the last of the Stuart consorts. See you next time.
Bye-bye.